RCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A state of emergency declared at the fiery traffic accident site on I-95 in southwestern Connecticut by Governor Ned Lamont. Repairs will take a few days, says the governor.
My recommendation is if you can't stay home, take the train, stay away from the cars.
A police officer involved in clearing protesters from a Columbia University administration building in New York fired his gun inside the hall, says the DA's office. Nobody hurt. Announcing billions to fix a nationwide health hazard, President Biden in Wilmington, North Carolina.
The only way forward is to replace every lead service line that connects Americans to clean water. That's why Kamala and I are making sure the administration is the first ever to set out to do it, and we're going to get it done.
Hawaii's Maui County is suing major cellular phone companies for failing to properly inform police of widespread service outages during the height of last summer's deadly wildfire. This is ABC News.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Amtrak will start a second passenger train route between St. Paul and Chicago later this month. The Borealis trains begin service on the 21st. The new trains follow the current Empire Builder route between St. Paul and Milwaukee and the Hiawatha stops between Milwaukee and Chicago. There'll be 8 stops in Wisconsin. Donald Trump telling a Waukesha rally Wednesday he supports the law enforcement crackdown on the pro-Palestinian protest encampment at UW-Madison.
To every college president, I say remove the encampments immediately. Vanquish the radicals and take back our campuses for all of the normal students who want a safe place from which to learn.
Police say 34 people were arrested, but only 4 of them went to jail. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday you had Donald Trump doing the campaign thing. Was Waukesha, Wisconsin, he was in. Asked the question, made the statement 3 years ago, we were a great nation and we will be a great nation again. The question, who was president in May of 2021? Do you remember, Donald? Do you remember who was president? Now, I know my red hat friends still believe Donald Trump's president today, which, you know, again, if things are so bad and he's president, I know, don't even think about it. But in his rambling speech, and look, I think the thing that's interesting is Fox News isn't playing his speeches like they used to in their entirety. We're not seeing it slapped all over right now because they're a rambling mess. Mispronounced words, you know, thoughts that take who knows what turn. For instance, he said the GOP is crashing. The GOP is crashing. The GOP plunging by more than 50%. The GOP, he meant GDP, I believe. But, you know, what orifice was this more than 50% number pulled? Because in fact, someone did ask, I guess, and he didn't know either. And this is another one of those examples of, well, we're just going to make things up, you know, as we go. Pull some stuff out of, you know, various orifices, if we will. Also, he said that anyone who opposed him, anyone who had the audacity, the unmitigated gall, they were more dangerous than dictators like Vladimir Putin. Yeah. If you are against another Trump administration, you are worse than Putin. And I guess you've got to give him credit for, you know, thinking highly of himself. But I got to tell you, the things that he's talking about, kind of freaky, kind of weird. For instance, he did say that, and point blank, he said he's going to end the Inflation Reduction Act. And you go, well, what? I don't think most people know what the Inflation Reduction Act did and does. But the number one thing in my mind is it created a 15% corporate minimum tax rate, which means that, well, those 55 companies from a couple years ago that paid zero would have to pay something. Also put a whopping 1% excise tax on these billions and billions of dollars in stock buybacks. Now you go, but Rick, you know, understand, as you talked about yesterday on the show, Elon Musk and the billionaire class, they need that money. They need that 1%, you know, because, well, they don't have enough. Because it's never going to be enough, is it? Also, for working people, remember, it capped the price of insulin for folks on Medicare, $35. That he wants to undo. Medicare recipients saw a cap on out-of-pocket prescription drug costs starting in 2025, $2,000. Wants to undo that. Wants to make drug profits great again. Wants to ensure that the drug companies continue to fill the coffers, if you will. Also, there were some subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, which now, interestingly enough, a lot of people are going, hey, this isn't so bad. The fear of the GOP or the GDP, let's go that route. The fear of the GOP is that people would like the ACA or the dreaded Obamacare, and they might want to make it better. And understand, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act made a lot of energy investments, a lot of climate investments. It's moving us in a direction to do some things that scientists say we need to do to leave this planet a little bit better than we were going, to have our kids be able to inherit something that's worth inheriting. Kind of something I've asked for a while. But that's where the Trump mindset is. And there was a ton more. I mean, just, I don't know how you sit and you listen to the rambling. I know the faithful go and, you know, it's a party atmosphere or whatever, but I don't know how you sit through a whole spiel. I don't know how you do it. He used to be entertaining. Now it seems like it's about grievance. And, you know, if he's going to be a dictator, I think he's going to be a whiny dictator. Now, yesterday, obviously, was International Workers' Day, what was supposed to be Labor Day around the world. And Democrats in the House re-upped their messaging bills. And understand, they don't control the House. So putting out legislation that would be good for working people is saying their priorities. This is what Democrats are saying. Hey, this is stuff we think is important. Republicans are not taking it up. And again, as I've said, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do, or in this case, what they're not doing. They're not allowing these pieces of legislation to come to the floor. For instance, the Empowering Striking Workers Act, brought forth by Adam Schiff. AOC's on this, Donald Norquist. There are folks who are saying, look, you know, if you go on strike, you'll be eligible for unemployment after 14 days. So if it's a short strike, good. You'll take the hit. But if it's one of these long, drawn-out ones, we're going to level the playing field a little bit by ensuring that families don't starve in the process. Because one of the union-busting tactics, and we saw it with the Writers Guild, we're going to starve them out. We're going to make them go broke. We're going to make them homeless. And this would help a little bit. Now, understand, unemployment doesn't in any way replace the loss of wages. I think it's like 35, 40%, but it's something. Also, The Food Security Strike Act is something that they put forth. House Resolution 4845. This would undo all the restrictions for striking workers to get SNAP benefits. So if you're on strike, you're not going to go hungry. Sounds like a good thing to me. Also, H.R. 1447, Striking and Locked Out Worker Health Care Protection Act, because another thing that employers do when a strike happens, cut off your health care benefits, make you desperate, because that's what it's really about. It's about making working people desperate, keeping them under the thumb, and health care is one of those things. So by passing this legislation, they wouldn't be able to do that. And, you know, for me, you go, another reason why we don't have employer-sponsored healthcare. I've always thought it's a bad idea. This is one of those things. They also came out with a couple worker safety bills, the Workers Power Act, that would strengthen the capacity and the resources of the Department of Labor to enforce labor law, you know, kind of crack down on wage theft, crack down on child labor, crack down on OSHA violations, you know, enforce the law that we have. Give them the resources to put a cop on the beat to make sure that our working people are safe. Also, the Protecting America's Workers Act, it would strengthen and modernize OSHA, ensure employers address hazardous working conditions, protect worker whistleblowers who, you know, are the ones right there. So protecting them from retaliation and holding people accountable. I think something, again, we should all want. And now these, understand, are messaging bills, but they're the right messages. Also a heat protection bill, the Heat Illness, Injury, and Fatality Protection Act, that is H.R. 4897, would direct OSHA to establish a permanent federal standard to protect workers across the country. People exposed to excessive heat, outdoor, indoor, doesn't matter. Have a standard. Make sure universally everyone is on the same page. Now, these are great things. These are things working people should want. And things I don't think we hear enough about. Now, understand, when we talk about politics, it's always about the horse race. I see the New York Times doing their foolhardy best to make this, down to the wire, you know, Trump and Biden neck and neck. And we see these polls that are crafted in such a way that, you know, it's neck and neck. I don't know that it is, but we need to make it, I guess, we need to make it a horse race because, well, then they won't make a bunch of money. But my problem is we don't talk about real issues. We talk about, well, they're old. We talk about he fell asleep. Talk about, you know, maybe he let out a noise in the courtroom. Instead of how are things going to make your life better? For instance, the Democrats have got another piece of legislation, H.R. 7315, the Pre-Apprenticeship to Hard Hats Act. This would provide grants to develop pre-apprenticeship programs in the building and construction trades, to serve underprivileged areas, underrepresented areas, people from low incomes, people from rural communities, give them the ability to get the skills and the training they need to get a decent job. Seems reasonable for me. But there's a bunch of this stuff that goes, hey, we want to make sure that we train the next generation of workers, that they're not saddled with a lifetime of debt, and that we can rebuild this country with the money that we've already allocated for, you know, new technology, for reshoring manufacturing, for investing in the energy of the future. You need the people to do it. We need the hands to get in there and do the work. Here is legislation. Now, I ask the question, because this, again, comes back to Republicans are trying to be the party of working people. They're trying to make that pivot. Where's their version of this stuff? Where is their version of making workers' lives better? Because all I keep seeing coming out of them is, well, division, outrage, nonsense. We keep fighting over nonsense, and we're not fighting for making this a better country for working people. It seems that the owners are very happy with the status quo, whereas we should be demanding better. And we can have better. And I think what Biden has been doing the last 3 years, in case you didn't know, is moving us in the right direction. Moving us in a direction that's going to make lives better. Going to build a future for our children that's going to make things better. And give opportunity and reward to work. For me, that's the big thing. I want to hear your thoughts. But lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sean Rickman's going to be here. Share some thoughts on these big organizing victories. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So yesterday was May Day, International Workers Solidarity Day. And then look, you know, you think about, you know, how this day kind of came about. You go back to the 1880s and the whole push for the 8-hour day, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. And as I said yesterday, one of the things I'd like to see is maybe now we take up the call. Well, for a 32-hour work week, and good on the UAW for putting that on the table. And I'll tell you, it's amazing to me. And I, as I said a couple of weeks ago, I now have even more, I give more credit. I have more reverence for the people who fought and won the 8-hour day, given the fact that some of the messaging around the 32-hour day, very, very strange stuff. But here to share some thoughts on where we are as we move out of International Workers Day and look at some of the things that are happening here in our own backyard. I've asked Sean Rickman to come talk with us. Sean is a contributing writer at In These Times, also author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of what we're seeing? I mean, you know, the UAW just won a massive historic victory in the South in Tennessee at Volkswagen. There's talk of a victory at Mercedes. There could be a spark across the South. What do you think of where we are right now?
It's a very exciting moment, and it's unclear to me how much of this is the world shaking and changing, and how much of this is just really good, smart union leadership meeting up with very competent pro-worker National Labor Relations Board. The UAW campaign in Chattanooga at Volkswagen was just plain good organizing. It was just following the science, following, you know, decades of research from Kate Bronfenbrenner and others about what effective union tactics are, about having a rank and file organizing committee that is representative of the workers, that is empowered to make decisions so that the union isn't us and not this third party agency, just good, clean unionism. And maybe that was enough to win where the union had failed in two previous efforts at that factory. Maybe that plus an NLRB that was going to find more employer violations of the law, more unfair labor practices, and run more streamlined and quicker elections. That's entirely possible. But the vote itself, which was a greater than 2-1 ratio of 2.5-1,
73-27.
That's suggestive of something that's more of a sea change in worker attitudes, even in the South, because you go into a campaign like this, you know, with I think they had upwards of 80% support of workers on petitions and cards for an election. You know, the onslaught of the employers' campaign, five or six governors from across the South speaking out against this, as it happened in previous campaigns, where the entire weight of the power establishment in the city and in the state came down on the on those workers, basically saying these jobs could go away, this factory could get shut down if you form a union, and that's why you shouldn't. That would tend to lose a lot of votes, and so this was the same attitudes of workers, but with better organizing. I think I would have expected to see a more narrow victory, but this was a blowout win, which suggests that workers are really calling BS on these boss talking points, and they're really fed up with we do all the work gets harder every year, and the profits really don't get shared with us, and that it is time for a better deal for workers.
No, I think it is the perfect storm. And as you pointed out, you've got the NLRB, who this election was very quick, and you had you had the people who were doing the organizing work with the UAW. You had the members who were moving in that direction. So it was the perfect storm. Does this translate to bigger victories down the road, do you think? Because I'm looking at the Alabama case, and I'm hoping that goes that way. But does this go beyond that?
We hope so, right? You have to hope so. But one thing that you just can't discount is the extent to which workers are, there's still a caution that many workers have, and particularly around, well, those workers are different. That situation is different than mine. So the UAW moving across other factories in the South, I think Mazda is up next. I'm feeling pretty bullish on the UAW continuing to rack up victories, because I think that auto workers see other auto workers organize and win, and they say, I can do that too. Just as the way of organizing that ran through Starbucks locations in the last few years was built upon other Starbucks workers seeing other Starbucks workers organize and win and going for it. Or the digital newsrooms of journalists. But, you know, from my experience, you know, I was an organizing director at the American Federation of Teachers. I was responsible for the union's charter school organizing division. And, you know, we had a moment more than 10 years ago, when we found ourselves in private sector jurisdiction under the NLRB, whereas previously we thought charter schools were public schools, so we were under this patchwork of public sector rules. So we're like, we're under the private sector, that means we really actually have to organize and prepare for strike, that we're probably not going to get contracts without an effective strike threat. And so we started shifting gears and building this into our conversations with our organizing committees. And it was a very, very heavy lift. Even in the city of Chicago, where all of the district school teachers went on strike in 2012, and then again a few years later, big, very successful strikes. Even in the city of Chicago, a teacher at a charter school looking at their colleagues across the street at the district school going on strike and winning, still would say, well, that's different. The nature of their employer is fundamentally different than the nature of my employer. Their boss is all the way across town. There's this school board. There's a whole lot of layers of bureaucracy before it gets to me. Me, I see my boss every day. They get in my face about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And there, I'm sure that there would be much harsher retaliation if we went on strike. And it took years to get the first group of teachers out of charter school in the city of Chicago to go on strike. I wasn't there for it. I think it was in 2017 or 2018. Workers definitely watch their brothers and sisters across industries and across the country. But the further that a group of workers are from them, further from their industry or further from their city, the harder it is to make that leap of I can do it too. So that's a thing to watch out for here. And you know, it's why these very exciting sparks, like the new leadership at the UAW, like the new leadership at the IBT, are really important. We need more of it. It'd be great to see some more action in supermarkets and in retail, for example.
No, this could be that moment, Sean, where, you know, like my grandparents' generation, where every profession had a union, where, you know, worker 35% of the workforce was unionized, where you had, you know, good wages, hours, conditions for the mass of working people and built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. I feel like we're right there. The spark has been lit. The fear is that the moneyed interests, the rich and powerful this November, put the wrong guy in the White House and all of this stuff goes away because you then change all of those dynamics in the NLRB, in the Department of Labor, at the Federal Trade Commission, all those places. And now there's that heavy thumb. Not that the workers still won't be able to organize and the militancy won't continue, but I think it'd be a lot more difficult.
It's hard to overstate how important having a cop, for a lack of a better word, when it comes to labor law, somebody to step in and to say that goes beyond the pale, that can't be done, and restraining the worst instincts of the employers. If we didn't have an NLRB, they'd be shooting us. They were shooting us up until, you know, 1938. The NLRB is far from perfect. It's a hell of a lot better now than it has been any time since, I think, the 1960s. But it's also incredibly vulnerable. Anytime a Republican gets in there, under Reagan, they put in the appointees to the NLRB who were anti-union and would issue anti-union decisions. Now, I think they might just leave the positions vacant and let the machinery grind to a halt. That's preferable to them at this point because they have all kinds of abilities to get directly into court and get court injunctions against effective union tactics. We have to go to the NLRB and say, look, you know, they fired our leaders. They're threatening to close this factory if the workers vote for a union. You have to step in and tell them they can't do that. We need the NLRB for that. And so the NLRB is incredibly vulnerable to a change in parties in the White House. And it's also increasingly vulnerable to this insane Supreme Court, where bosses have been lodging appeals to overturn the Wagner Act, the 1934 National Labor Relations Act, 1935 rather, since 1935. And it's been relatively well established precedent that it can exist. It's been the Supreme Court sort of nibbling at the edges and diluting the effectiveness of the law. But lately you've had some bosses come in with these, you know, too cute by half arguments. They don't even have to be clever arguments. It basically is you know, this is a Supreme Court that's like, to hell with precedent, we don't like this, make it stop. And that is constantly a risk, regardless of who's in the White House, regrettably, until we have a major change.
I was going to bring this up because I think it's important to understand, you know, elections have consequences. And the guy who is running to get back in the White House has a track record. I look at Trump. His track record is bad all the way around. And, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting is the person that he put in charge of the wage and hour division, who's in charge of enforcing wage theft, accused of wage theft herself. So it's like putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
And there's nothing special about Trump in this regard. This is a thing I like to stress. When it comes to labor policy, it's the Heritage Foundation. It's a book. They've got a book. They're ready to run it. If Mitt Romney was president, he would have done the same thing that Donald Trump did. If John McCain had been president, he would have done the same thing. It's the same darn playbook. And Nikki, you know, if Donald Trump, you know, craps his pants and has a stroke and dies, and Nikki Haley's the candidate, she would do the same thing. It is a lock, stock, and barrel corporate agenda that Republicans just carry out without a thought in the world.
Well, we'll see where this takes us. But Sean, as always, I appreciate your thoughts, your expertise, your understanding. The book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century, written by Sean Richmond. Sean, I appreciate you taking time. Always great talking to you, man.
Thanks for having me.
Our good friend, Sean Richmond. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. What do you think? Are we heading towards another Roe kind of situation, another Janus kind of situation, where the NLRA goes the way of, well, no more precedent? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Showers and storms winding down. Plenty of clouds in the overnight and mid-40s by sunrise. Southwest winds turning to the west, and they will be gusty. We'll start off your Friday with some morning cloud cover, then sunshine breaking out. Lower 70s in the late day. It's 60 at our studios.
The Todd Alba Show.
State Senator Kelda Royce in Richland County. UW System made the unilateral decision to completely vacate the campus by July 1st of this year.
It's so short-sighted to think it costs a little bit more money to run it and there aren't as many students, so let's just shut it down. A smart business owner would say, now is the time to invest, because we know every person that comes through the door, you're going to get 40-fold the investment from how they're going to be able to give back to our state.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interestingly enough, yesterday on the program, we were talking about the old 70s TV show Good Times and how the idea of a union job equaled a better life and how that messaging in the show was front and center. You saw the main character who was hoping to get this union apprenticeship gig, thinking, hey, life is going to be easy. We're on easy street. We're moving on up. We're going to have food at the end of the month. The kids are going to have opportunities like never before. And as I said yesterday, you know, this idea that our media told that story, unlike the 80s and 90s, when you think about my union, the Teamsters Union, every time you saw a Teamster in the 90s, they were carrying a baseball bat. The messaging that we get from our media, from our art, and all of that, I think plays an important role, which is why I've asked Ken Grossman to come talk with us. Ken is a leading strategist in the fight for economic and social justice through community and labor organizing. He's also the author of the fabulous book, Artworks, How Organizing and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I've been looking forward to joining your show.
So, you know, I want to talk about this thing with this TV show. I mean, back in the 70s, you had a lot of this messaging through our film, through television, that, you know, unions were good, unions made lives better. It was the kind of messaging that helped, I think, helped working people, and I think moved us in a good direction, as opposed to what we've seen in the years later that has just been kind of the opposite.
Yeah, I think you could cite a lot of different examples. Some of Norman Lear's other shows included, as you may recall, All in the Family. All in the Family penetrated popular culture in a way that organizers haven't yet figured out to do. At the time that Norman Lear produced All in the Family, homophobia, anti-LGBTQ rights, discrimination and bigotry, they weren't part of kitchen table conversations. And so here is Norman Lear beaming in stories about bigotry, about homophobia, and now people are talking about it. And that's, you know, people have got to be emotionally primed to receive ideas, and it really enabled that.
Yeah, and look, you know, art and music and all of this, you know, music was something the labor movement used for decades to help move people towards organizing. These things connect with people in a way that's personal, in a way that they have an emotional connection with, and it becomes part of who they are.
You know, there's a section that I open up in the book that I'd love to read if I could, if you had a minute.
Sure.
There are two quotes. One from a guy named Wyatt T. Walker, who was the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the Civil Rights Movement in the early 60s. And he says this about one song, We Shall Overcome. He says, one cannot describe the vitality and emotion this one song evokes across the Southland. I have heard it sung in great mass meetings with 1,000 voices singing as one. I've heard 6 sing it softly behind the bars of the Hinds County Prison in Mississippi. I've heard old women singing it on the way to work in Albany, Georgia. I've heard the students singing it as they were being dragged away to jail. It generates power that is indescribable. And Bruce Hartford, a writer, said one other thing about this, not about We Shall Overcome, but about song in the civil rights movement. He says, for us, freedom songs were the psychic threads that bound the movement into a tapestry of purpose, solidarity, hope, and courage. The song spread our message. The songs bonded us together. The songs elevated our courage. The songs shielded us from hate. The songs forged our discipline. The songs protected us from danger. And it was the songs that kept us sane.
And, you know, you can take that into a lot of movements. And, you know, as you're talking about Thou Shalt Overcome, I'm thinking of, you know, Solidarity Forever in the labor movement as well. The same kind of visceral reaction you get, you know, at least I think, correct?
I think that song has a way of nurturing people's soul. It, as I said earlier, it penetrates popular culture. So it inspires us, it offers us hope, it sustains us in the fights. It performs a lot of different kind of roles. And it's really important also to note that it's not just the power of song, but the power of the artists themselves. We tend to think about well-known celebrity artists that did great songs that we sing for 20, 30, 40 years of our lives. But it's the artists themselves that carry the song throughout social movement. So a great example of that is somebody that your listeners will probably know is Cy Khan. Cy Khan's, 20, 25 CDs, playwright, and an organizer in the labor movement and an organizer in the civil rights movement. And Cy went up to Bristol Bay, Alaska, at the request of fishermen in Bristol Bay who were trying to stop the extractive mining industries from digging the largest open pit gold mine in the country and the second largest in the world. It would have been a disaster. And the fishermen, we're talking about fishermen that fish for commercial reasons, fishermen that fish for sustenance, fishermen that fish for sport. The fishermen realized after 10 years of this fight over something that was called Pebble Mine, they didn't have an anthem. They didn't have a theme song. And they implored Cy to come up to Bristol Bay, Alaska to write them one. And they took Cy into a third grade class, which was known as the Rebels to the Pebble. And Cy said, in whatever way you talk to third graders, I'll be your musical messenger if you tell me the message. And then he would write songs. And what made it different is he would take those songs into homes and play them for people. And he would say, what did you think about that line? What do you think about this song? Does it work? Do you want me to jettison it? And through that, he created trust. So it was the artist, not just the art, in collaboration with the organizers that gave that movement lift and led to something called Musicians United to Protect Bristol Bay. Which eventually Cy took down to the lower 48 and started traveling around the country raising money for this fight and enlisting other musicians.
No, there are amazing stories of this kind of thing. You know, I think back to, you know, during the Depression, you had one of Lewis Hines in his photographs told stories as well. And it's, you know, it's one of, as you were talking, it's one of the things that popped into my head. Those photos connect with people on a visceral level and scream out for action.
So there's another great story about photography, Rick. There's also from the civil rights movement. There's a photographer named Danny Lyon. You remember that a lot of white Northerners went south during the Southern Civil Rights Movement to volunteer their time. And James Forman, who at that time was the head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, understood that if he was going to expose the brutality of white supremacy in the South, he needed visual evidence that was uncontestable. And so Danny Lyon is one of the volunteers that goes south, and he happens to be a photographer. And James Forman says, I need you to find these girls. And what he was talking about was 33 teenage girls who were swept up protesting racial segregation in Georgia and locked away in the Leesburg stockade for 45 days. Their families for 45 days didn't know where they were. And Forman says to Lyon, you've got to find these girls. And along with two civil rights workers, he goes and he does find them. The civil rights workers distract the guards. Danny takes photographs of them through broken windows and bars, brings them back to Forman, who then sends them out into the media, picked up by Senator Harrison, a senator from Pennsylvania at the time, entered into the congressional record. That then was seen by Robert F. Kennedy, who was that time the attorney general, and those girls were swiftly released. So it was the idea that art is not just a reflection of or a reaction to social conditions, but a contributor to social change.
No, and you know, when we, back in 2015, we did a civil rights tour. Civil labor's involvement in the civil rights movement was the theme of it. And we went to a lot of places where blacks were treated poorly, well, worse than poorly. And now there's tourism. They've got museums going, look how bad we were. And in the photographs there, you know, as you were talking about this, I'm thinking about all of the horrible photos and the things that are there to remind us of the past, the history of the past, to elicit. And I would imagine at the time were taken to elicit some bit of demand for change for people who are sympathetic.
Yeah.
So how does this, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, a little bit about the labor movement, a lot about the civil rights movement. How does that move to today? To, you know, you go, well, that was back then. How does art play into this today? I know you talk a lot about the George Floyd mural in Minnesota. Was that the catalyst for you writing this book? Was that the spark?
Well, somewhat. So the primary driver here was that I have been in organizing for 35 years. And when I was taught how to think about my craft, when I practiced it, and when I started teaching younger organizers how to think about it, art and culture were never part of the mix. And I realized I missed the big boat. I married an artist. And through her work, I learned that it wasn't just organizers that didn't think strategically about art and culture, but it was artists themselves that didn't think about their work in the service of social movements. And like you, I want to win. And what we know how to do through organizing, through lobbying, through advocacy and campaigns, is sometimes we can win policy and legislative victories. But what happens is when power changes hands, those victories get rolled back. And I think that they get rolled back because we never address the narratives that underlie these fights. And art has the capacity to do that. Cultural interventions have the capacity to do that. So I wanted to write a book that spoke to what it would take for a lasting social change, because I think as a labor movement, as a group of people involved in community organizing, we've missed a boat. It is not just the organizing, not just appealing to the rational, but we've got to appeal to the heart. We've got to change people's attitudes and values. And that's why I wrote the book.
No, absolutely. I'm spot on. I'm right there with you. I for 19 years doing this program, I've been telling my labor friends, you got to get out there and have people tell their stories. It's not about, hey, we just get better wages, hours, conditions. It's about how we make lives better and how those lives have been affected, and get out there and have people share their stories and connect. That narrative is more important, I think, most of the time than the actual facts. Because people want to connect with things, and art being a big part of this, which is why I think in this digital age, a lot of the videos that we see of people sharing their stories, a lot of the memes of how lives get better through, you know, collective action, I think that's really important.
And the right has understood the role of culture throughout history, going back to 1915, when Birth of a Nation was made. Birth of a Nation doubled the number of Ku Klux Klan chapters in this country. And then there was, of course, Triumph of Will during Hitler's period. And then as late as the primary debate, Rich Man North of Richmond. You remember they opened, Fox News opened their a debate with a song that was allegedly aimed at mocking us, when in fact these artists said it was aimed at mocking them. So the right has understood this, the right uses it, and it's not that the left hasn't, we have, but we haven't done the work on scale, and labor, like others, need to figure out new strategies to embrace it.
No, I absolutely agree with you. You know, one of the things that I talk about, you know, quite often when I give speeches is, you know, time and repetition. You give me enough time and enough repetition, you know, we like the right did, you'll change hearts and minds, which is how you got a lot of union members buying into right-wing talking points without even thinking. In fact, the reason this show started 19 years ago is I had a fellow union member tell me we'd make more money here if there was no union here. Because he had been told that repeatedly for months and years, and he internalized it. And then when he was called on it, he couldn't back it up and made him think, oh, but maybe I was wrong. Yeah. And we need to obviously combat that kind of misinformation. But also on the side, I think you're right. We need to do more in reaching out to people in these spheres. So is there anyone doing this well on the left? Are there any labor unions that you think are going, hey, they're doing okay here?
You know, I spent so long in the labor movement at the AFL-CIO, running legislative field operations at SEIU before that. I hate to be critical, but I don't think that labor is shining in this way. As you said earlier, video and film have been important components of labor's work. Graphic design has been important components. And historically, theater, El Teatro Campesino, the skits in the fields during the Great Boycott were important. Going back to 1939, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, Pins and Needles, a play performed not by actors and actresses professionally, but by workers, had the longest Broadway run in the history of theater at the time. So we have touched upon it, we've had some success, but we really haven't embraced it. And SEIU to this day, although Randy Weingarten from the AFT gets it, she blurred my book, SEIU has invited me to come to talk about this, but it hasn't been widespread. And it's sort of the next frontier I'm hoping to open up.
No, I think it's important. And you know, this is something that I've talked about for a while as well, that we need to be talking to people in a way that connects with them in their space. And something clearly we haven't, in my view, haven't done, at least in the last, you know, 35 years of my carrying a union card. So last question I've got for you. What are you hoping? Obviously, I think I have the answer. I think we just went through it. But what are you hoping comes of this? Do you think, you know, there can be this flourishing of art and music and all of this stuff that can help change the world? Or do we miss another opportunity, which is what I kind of fear?
Well, what I see happening in my limited universe is that I'm not just being asked to come to speak about the book. I've been doing a lot of public speaking about the book, but I'm asked to come back to organizations that are grappling with the question of how do you do this? So I've met with People's Action who have asked me to talk to their communications cohort, to their organizers, to the staff more broadly. They're trying to think strategically, as is Greenpeace and the environmental movement. They're trying to think strategically. So I think we're beginning to see an opening up, and I just want to do as much as I can to crack the egg.
Well, I hope people take a look at the book, Artworks, How Organizers and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Ken, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good work. I'd love to talk to you again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts. Something catch your ear, catch your eye, something that makes you think about, well, better lives, better opportunities, more engagement. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the birthday of Richard Trevelyan, one of the early leaders of the U.S. labor movement and the fight for the eight-hour workday. Of English descent, Richard was the son of a Cornish farmer. As a young man, Trevelyan took up the trade of a ship carpenter. Soon after, he traveled to Australia to seek his fortune and to prospect for gold. The horrible working conditions caused him to speak out for workers in Australia and New Zealand before arriving in the United States. First, he came to New Orleans, where he became involved in the trade union movement. When the Civil War broke out, he traveled north. In 1862, he settled in Detroit, working in the Detroit dry docks. Soon after, Richard became president of the Ship Carpenters and Caulkers International Union. He was well known as an eloquent speaker for the cause of labor. He founded the Detroit Trades Assembly. A short-lived organization, the assembly attempted to bring together skilled tradesmen to organize for improved working conditions and hours. His skills as an orator often put Trevelyan in high demand in the nearby city of Chicago. On the 4th of July celebration held by the Chicago Trades Assembly in 1965, Trevelyan called for the eight-hour workday. In his speeches, Trevelyan advocated that workers should not see a reduction of pay for working 8 hours. Instead, he argued that increased productivity of workers should allow their wages to stay steady. He was also a proponent of worker education. He argued that a well-read workforce could better articulate its demands. In 1869, he was elected president of the National Labor Union, an early attempt to join workers across the country under the banner of one organization. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Again, the book Artworks. I hope folks will take a look at that by Ken Grossinger. And I'm sure you get that at your favorite bookstores, but Artworks, how organizers and artists are creating a better world together. Hope you'll check that out. Look, I'm all in favor of getting the message however you can. I've been saying for a very long time, the right has mastered the use of time and repetition in every sphere. I mean, the memes that I see constantly, you remember the chain emails that used to come out? Republicans spend the money, the resources, the time, the energy through their think tanks, focus group tested, think tank approved, to inundate us with their messaging. And I got to tell you, workers don't have that kind of time, don't have that kind of resources. But I think you have just as compelling stories when you start talking about people being able to move out of their parents' basement and buy their first home. When you talk about people who are able to take care of themselves and their family and have opportunity in the future. Those are good things. Those are all important things. And I hope we do a much better job. But, you know, wrapping up today, I'm looking at the races coming around the country. And one of the themes that we're seeing, especially on the Republican side, is this, this senatorial, this congressional tourism, where rich people are going, gee, what state could I go to run for office? You may remember Dr. Oz here in Pennsylvania tried to run from Jersey. Well, we got another one of those. Dave McCormick evidently lives in Connecticut. And I'm not sure what it is about the Republicans in Pennsylvania that they can't find someone who lives here. Is it that there are no Republicans who want to run in this state, or is it they just don't have the money? And this is the weird thing, because you look at these candidates that they're going after. These are billionaires. I've been saying this for a while. This is like the new polo. This is the rich people stomping ground. This is the hey, look at me, status thing. I think there's a huge part of this. And also, look, reality being what it is, these are people who know that the legislative process benefits them. It used to be in the past they would pay people to do these jobs. They would invest in candidates to get them what they want. And maybe they got what they wanted and maybe they didn't. Maybe they didn't get all they wanted. Now they want it all. So they're going to do it themselves. And along with it, get the pomp and circumstance that comes with it. But is it surprising that, you know, in Wisconsin, you've got, you know, what they're saying is a carpetbagger, Montana, here in my state, Michigan, Nevada. My favorite one, I think, is Nevada. The guy in Nevada evidently ran in Texas as well for a couple of election cycles ago and, you know, said something along the lines of, you know, how did it go? There's nothing going to take me out of my state. One of those cold, dead hand kind of things where you go, are you sure? Are you sure this is where you want to go? No, wait a minute. It was literally, it would take an act of God to move him out of Texas. Now, the weird thing is, I was listening to Mike Lindell give his pre-Trump kind of spiel of how, you know, Donald Trump is just a big bucket of common sense. Yeah, he's a big bucket of common sense. And there's nobody more courageous. And you've heard all this stuff. But played that God frame that, you know, we need, you know, all this stuff and it's all biblical and, you know, as if we're, as if God has a vested interest and is the party of the Republican Party, which is, again, very, very strange to me because that's not how I learned it. But understand, carpetbagging, not new. I mean, there are tons of stories that have gone. You know, Herschel Walker in the last series of elections. In fact, I was down in Georgia in 2022. When Herschel Walker was running in the special election after the election that he ended up losing. And I don't have, I have no idea how he even got into it, as bad of a candidate as he was, especially running against Reverend Warnock. But he lived in Texas. But hey, why not? Why not move him to Georgia? He was popular there. We've seen, you know, this happen. Scott Brown, after he lost his seat in 2012 in Massachusetts, went across the border to New Hampshire and tried to run there. Didn't work. There are tons of stories. And I would be remiss without pointing out that, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, all their fame and fortune came out of being Bill being, you know, out of Arkansas. Now Hillary did, have some space there. But she could be called the most successful carpetbagger because she moved to New York and then became senator there. You know, Mitt Romney, another one, was Massachusetts governor and then moved to Utah and won a Senate seat out there. So this isn't new, and voters, I guess, are, you know, somewhat used to it. But you go, I don't know, I think I want somebody who lives in the neighborhood. I think I want somebody who, you know, knows what we the people want. Or do you think, and this is the question, do you think that, you know, most people don't care? Because maybe they're jaded to the point to where they don't think that these politicians care. You know, I was looking up, you know, quotes from labor leaders today. Because one of the things I want to do from, you know, as we go forward is talk about, you know, some of the views labor leaders have on this upcoming election. And Sean Fain's name, you know, came up. And, you know, the fact that he said, look, I'm not going to meet with Donald Trump. He's the problem. He's the guy for the billionaire class. He's the guy who cares about the billionaires. He doesn't care about workers. He doesn't care about what happens to working people. He doesn't care about families who are struggling to make ends meet. He doesn't care about any of this stuff. He cares about himself and his buddies. And I'm like, you know, that right there, that's the frame. That's the reality of what we should be talking about on looking at Trump as someone who doesn't care about you or me or anyone else. He cares about himself. He cares about his class. And to steal the Warren Buffett quote, you know, it's class warfare. My class is winning, but we shouldn't be. And this is where working people should be coming together and going, you know, we want one of us, someone who knows what it's like to work paycheck to paycheck to try and make ends meet. Wouldn't that be a novel concept? A Senate full of people who had to worry about paying the rent next month? I think it would. I think that's where I'd like to see it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the show, grab the podcast or freespeech.org. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at thericksmithshow.com.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.